We're not far from the Rodin Museum on the Parkway in Philadelphia. Perhaps you've been there. Poet Dennis Patrick Slattery has wrestled for a while with the sculptor's work, trying to understand the artist's power in his own time and for us here and now. In writing about Auguste Rodin, Slattery asks us to consider that artistic images of the wounded human body can be almost myth-like presences that encourage us to live deeply within the scars of one another, and in that way, to feel a connection with another human on a profound, soulful level. Rodin, he says, sensed that the clay figure actually became unique as much by what he removed from it in order to coax the shadows from it, as by what he left intact, saying, "The part you don't see is the most important." Slattery suggests Rodin might in fact be our artistic patron saint of the modern wounded body because of his insights into the dance between surface and depth. That from an essay titled Auguste Rodin's Shadowy Wounded Bodies. And we keep all this in mind as we turn to Hetty Bays, an artist whose way of working was totally transformed when she was drawn into the mysterious dance of surface and depth, the play of shadow and light in a drawing studio while still in school. And she came to experience the truth in Slattery's sense that artistic and poetic images can lead us to live deeply within the scars of another when she read the ancient classic Homer's Odyssey. In his reading of the epic, Slattery focuses on Odysseus and the pronounced scar on his thigh from the charge of a boar. It was not that theme, but the scene where, upon the hero's homecoming, the serving women are gathered and summarily killed. It was that scene which roused Hetty to create what many would consider her most powerful body of work. As if she heard there a chorus of anguished voices, cries of the deepest wounding, pain accumulated over a lifetime, and lives now ending with execution instead of mercy, as Jacqueline Gerson might express it, and finding herself participating in the mysterious realms of these interrupted lives. And it's not a surprise that Hetty Bays listens well and could hear such silent voices so deeply. She tells us, almost in passing, that she studied violin while she was growing up, and invariably we know she would have had to tune her instrument regularly to be able to share those sounds to the best of her ability. And we're about to learn how all these threads have come together in her art and heart, and how she prepares herself, her body, her true instrument, for the work that has become her life. Hetty Bays is a visual artist working in mixed media. She grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, and she has shown her work in numerous solo and group exhibitions, both nationally and internationally, including the Incheon International Women Artists Biennial in South Korea. Most recently, a solo exhibit at the Woodrow Wilson School, Princeton University, featured her paintings in conjunction with a symposium led by ethicist Peter Singer. Hetty Bays has taken part in collaborative art projects in China, Tibet, Dubai, Australia, and France. She is a featured exhibiting artist with Artworks for Freedom, an organization that uses the power of art to raise awareness about modern-day slavery and human trafficking. In addition to her studio practice, Bays has taught creativity and community-building workshops at Princeton University, Syracuse, and Rutgers. Since 2010, she has been an artist-in-residence and art instructor with an NGO that supports underserved women in the informal settlements outside of Cape Town, South Africa. Hetty Bays is a graduate of Wyoming Seminary in Kingston. She received a BFA from Cornell University and an MBA from Columbia University. Her exhibition titled This Very Body will open on Saturday with a reception at Marywood University in Scranton. Hetty Bays paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about her life's work and her early days in the Wyoming Valley, growing up with a highly respected artist, Betty Bays.
I did not take any art classes in high school. And I think it's because my mother had such a huge influence on me as an artist growing up. You know, from the time I was little, she started going to New York in the very early 50s. She would take the Martz bus from Wilkes-Barre to New York to paint with Hans Hofmann's school on 8th Street. And she'd come home, she'd leave like at midnight or something, and it was a long bus ride then. I think it was about 5 hours. And she'd come home in the morning with these wild abstract expressionistic paintings, and she'd put them out in the living room. She was very excited. And she'd say to my father, "Oh, Chris, what do you think of these?" And it was the 50s in Wilkes-Barre. And he'd look at them, and he'd say, "Well, I will have to live with them." And I'd come out in my pajamas and look at them and say, "Oh, Mommy, they're beautiful. I love them." So we had just this instant connection in art. And so growing up, for me, there were always art materials around. My mother had a studio. She painted every day. And so she had just a very direct way of painting. She said to me, "Just don't be afraid. Put red down on the canvas. Move it around. If red says, 'I want blue,' you put blue down. And it's a total dance. And you just paint directly on the canvas with big brushes. Don't get picky. Don't get fussy." So she was really a fabulous teacher for me and really taught me to paint very intuitively and spontaneously.
What a gift.
What a gift.
And she was not just a dabbler. She was a remarkable artist. You see her images and they grip you.
They're powerful. They're powerful and very direct and very expressive. And after studying with Hofmann, then she connected with a group in New York, and she would go and paint in New York. And as a matter of fact, several blocks from where I subsequently ended up living in a loft with my husband years later. She was 23rd and 6th, and we were 26th and 6th Avenue.
So you did then paint, but your own things
all along.
I
just worked all the time at home. I painted, I drew. I remember one day going into the refrigerator to get something to eat, and it was full of clay because at the time she was making pottery. She says, "There's no food in the house. It's a refrigerator of clay." And also, when she went to Hofmann's class, he took her on the provision that she would copy his notes. So every evening, my parents would sit with Hans Hofmann's notes, trying to decipher exactly what he was talking about, trying to really understand. He wrote this book called The Search for the Real, and they would talk about it, they'd read the notes, and so it was very much a part of my life. And then when I went away to college, I was a liberal arts major, I went to Bard initially, and I found myself just painting and drawing all the time in my room, and I remember finally calling my mother and saying, "You know what, I think I'm going to be an art major." And she said, much to my surprise, "I was wondering when you were going to say that."
She knew.
She knew. She knew. So that began. And I started really more formally studying art in college.
In those explorations in college, then, were you finding your way in terms of what you wanted to work with in terms of the media? You were going to work directly, yes? That was
right. Directly, spontaneously, intuitively, no pre-planning. Big brushes, big palettes, big canvases. Whatever materials were available, rags, paper, anything. And so I started out at Bard, and it was a great art department when I was there. The faculty came from New York. They were working artists. They would come up for 2 or 3 days and then go back to the city. So it was very dynamic. And then after 2 years there, I also went to a place called Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture for a summer and worked with Jacob Lawrence, who's pretty prominent, and a man named Robert Goodnow, and I had a wonderful experience there. That was a wonderful residency. And then after 2 years at Bard, because Bard at the time only had 500 students in the woods, I said, "I need something a little bigger." So I transferred to Cornell, and I had known Cornell because I went to a summer program there. And there I met a woman, Jillian Peterson Craig, who totally opened me up to a new way of working. up until then, I just had my way. I was painting expressively, directly, whatever came up, I would respond to. And she had a different sensibility that has been with me ever since. So I took a drawing class, and it was in Ithaca, and very wintry gray skies. And I remember climbing up to the top floor of this very old art department, staircase after staircase. And this room at the top of the stairs had northern skylights, so it was a very gray, dark room with just this winter light coming through the skylights. And I entered that room, that space, and in the far corner was a model, all in shadow except for a little ray of light hitting her forehead, her nose, her shoulder was illuminated from just the rays of winter light that fell through this skylight, and Mozart was playing on the radio. And it was silent except for that. And I just remember walking into the space and I felt transformed, because here was this figure emerging from darkness and light and classical music playing. And I was transported into another world, and she really awakened, setting that model up and creating that environment where you're just working with darks and lights, pulling the figure out of darkness with your eraser. It just resonated with me in a very deep way, very, very deep way, and opened me up to the beauty and the mystery of the human body and the darkness and light and just forms coming out and disappearing into darkness and light. So it was mysterious. There was a spiritual element to it. It was just very inspiring and completely different from my mother's approach, but it awakened this in me.
But you had been prepared for something like this, for being sensitive to being affected by environment.
Yes, yes. I mean, I also was a violinist. I had grown up playing the violin, so I was very much open to music and hearing the Mozart and the music. And when my mother painted when I was growing up, she'd always have Bach playing, or she came home with Ravi Shankar records in the 50s. And so music, for me, always went with creating. And as a matter of fact, even to this day, I will have to say, I'm going to give a plug to WVIA. It's on in my studio when I paint. I listen to classical music, and I find it really is an integral part for me of being expressive and settling me down. You know, getting out of the verbal frame of mind and hearing and sensing and being sensitive to that aspect of experience.
So it's much more than eyes.
Much more than eyes. And it has to do, for me, also with meditation. With when I saw this figure in the room, in the darkness and the light, it had a kind of mystery that almost a spiritual practice would bring to art. So that has also been an integral part. It's much fuller than just looking at something.
There you were in this room having this experience that was transfixing. How did you then proceed in terms of studying? Did you continue to draw? How did it shift your way of spending your time in a studio?
Mm-hmm. Well, the process that I really loved that Jillian, and by the way, Jillian and I are still friends today. We still see each other. We still communicate. It might only be once a year, but we have a very deep connection. We really connected through art. So the process that she taught, which I loved and I had never done before, was she had us take large pieces of paper and a piece of charcoal with a file, like a little filing that you might file your nails with, and shave the charcoal onto this blank piece of white paper and then rub it in. So what we had was a gray piece of paper. And then as we saw light, instead of outlining the model, as we saw the light on the face, we would use an eraser, a very soft eraser, and pull the nose out of the darkness, having it emerge from that ground of charcoal gray light. And so to me, that was another eye-opening experience. So I continued to work that way for a number of years. And then once I left school, I kind of experimented in other ways, but it always stayed with me. It stayed with me until 2003, believe it or not. It was dormant It was dormant in me, and I was always drawn to images of darkness and light. And in 2003, and even the figure, I stopped working with the figure, but in 2003, living in Princeton, New Jersey, we had lived in New York for a period of time and moved to Princeton, New Jersey, and I was invited to join a group of professional artists who exhibited together. And this group would have thematic exhibits. So the decision was made to read Robert Fagles, who was a professor at Princeton at the time. He had done a translation of the Odyssey, a new translation of the Odyssey. And the group decided that we would all read the Odyssey and then respond. So I was reading the Odyssey and getting into it, loving it. But toward the end, there was a passage that just jumped out and totally, like, I said, I have to do this. I have to do this. So Odysseus, who's been away for 20 years from his home, finally, and struggling to come home, finally makes it home. And to find that there were all these men in his palace, in his castle, pursuing his wife. They wanted the power. They wanted to become king. They wanted to rule. And they had been living in his home for 20 years, trying to win his wife, Penelope. And he came in and he was enraged that there were all these suitors. And he systematically had them murdered in a very brutal way. But what really got to me was after these men were murdered, he understood that they had also been having affairs and loving with some of the young women who were also in the court. And after he murdered them, he brought all these young women out who had been their lovers. He had the women clean up the bodies, clean up the blood, and then rounded them up, backed them into the corner of a courtyard, and hung them all by their necks. And when I read this, I said, this is the most brutal, gory, awful thing I've ever heard. The hair stood up on my neck, and I said, this is what I have to do. This is it, because it affected me so viscerally. Like, I was horrified. I mean, really. And I didn't expect to have something that gruesome and that graphic. I mean, how many people read the Odyssey and realize that this is such an intensely graphic, moving tale? So I said, this is it. I'm doing this. And so I was at the lake at the time. My son and his cousin were visiting. My son at the time was 9. And I said to him, you and your cousin, have all you want, pizza, Coke, eat anything in the refrigerator all day, but don't talk to me until dinner time. And I went into this room. I took my art supplies, and I found, I wasn't thinking about it, I was just responding to this passage. I found myself painting, like putting paint on my arms, my torso, my legs, and pressing tissue paper on it and making a print of my own body. And then hanging these pieces up to dry, almost like I was going through this whole experience. And I didn't even, afterwards I looked back and I said, wow, I was doing that. But I wasn't thinking that I was doing what I was doing. It. These piece body parts were hanging in the room. Then when they dried, I started pulling them apart, collaging them into a piece that's about 6 feet high that I then attached to a piece of white canvas so that the figure itself is just suspended almost in midair. And I looked and I said, wow, that is open. It's taking me back to the figure, but on a completely different level, different plane, different process. And that really started me back working with the female figure and my own body and using my body to print. And then as this process evolved, I started adding materials to the figure. I used a blowtorch to burn. I would write inscriptions into the figure. And it became a whole, for me, a new way of making work. And those are the works that are on exhibit now at Marywood. It was very powerful for me.
You're saying that's life size?
That's life size, yeah. It's about 72 inches high. So that was the first one was like that. And then I continued to work with the body And I started using Japanese washi papers and inks, and also I started writing inscriptions into the figure. I would use a Dremel, which my husband has this tool, which is like it etches, and I started writing sutras and different words that would come up into my mind. But you can't really read them. I don't want to make it too clear. So there's a whole series of figures that were inspired by this whole process and kept me going and still keep me going.
What about the sense that it was inspired by Greek mythology or mythology, those stories that are so deep in our consciousness, subconscious, the sense that those words and the images are reverberating on a level that's not a declarative sentence in a non-fictional account of something that might have happened, for example?
Well, you know, I wasn't really thinking about it as much as having it deeply reverberate within me. And so what I can say about it is that it's very much alive, this mythology. And then it's resonating today, which really surprised me when I first started reading the Odyssey. I thought, oh, this is going to be an ancient myth. But it was powerful. It affected me so powerfully that it just came out in a visual response.
Even now, I can see that it's affecting you in this moment.
It is alive. And I reread the passages. I was going back over the passages that originally inspired me, and they are so contemporary and so vibrant and vital that energy is still being transmitted.
We do seem to be living more and more with our screens.
For me, it's really important to turn off my phone, turn off the internet, turn off the news. And as a matter of fact, my husband and I started this daily practice, because he's also an artist, of getting up in the morning and just having a cup of coffee in silence for half an hour, then sitting in silence where I do a meditation where I'm just following my breath. It's not a religious meditation, but it's a quieting, and just listening to the sounds of the birds, a truck going by, just paying attention to being in the moment. And then we would frequently also take an hour walk, also in silence, have a little bite of breakfast together in silence, and then each of us would go to our studios for 3 hours in silence. I would not have any phone. The only thing I would do would be turn on some classical music and have the music. And I really felt that when I enabled myself to have that silence, things started opening up and coming up that otherwise, with all the busyness of our information, we don't have time for. Our brains are too loaded to experience something bigger than ourselves.
And what then of the sense of embodiment? That must be a way of inhabiting your bodies, each of you, in that way, so that you become that conduit.
Yes. There's a saying, like, inside and outside become one. So whatever you are exposing yourself to, if you're open to it, can become a part of your internal experience. And that is exactly what happened to me in reading the Odyssey. And it happens sometimes just listening to birds. I mean, I feel sometimes my mind gets very busy and I'm thinking, oh, I have to do this, I have to do that. And then a bird will call outside of my window and I say, it's my teacher. The bird is telling me to just be present, let go of all the busy thoughts, and settle into the moment and be.
Stephen Alexander of Marywood wrote a remarkable essay expressing his understanding of these images that you've created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an amazing essay.
In reading his essay and just seeing these miniaturizations and not seeing the work itself, it sounds as if there is a sense of aliveness, presence on the surface. Like you had that reaction to the model when you stepped into that dark room, that presence there. Mm-hmm. Is that what happens, do you think, to you when you experience your own work?
I can sometimes look at the piece and actually understand where I was. So you have this experience or this visceral inner response, and as I'm working, it's coming out invariably. I'm not saying I am going to do this because this is how I think about that. I'm starting the work in response to something, be it the Odyssey. It can also be to music. It can be stimulus in my environment that I am taking in. And as I'm creating the piece, I'm not always aware of what the message is. So I'm hoping that as a result, there's a little bit of mystery, and I'm not trying to say this is exactly what this is about. I'm hoping that the viewer will then respond in his or her own way. And then also sometimes when I see the piece, I think, like when I described the Odyssey and making that figure, afterwards I thought, so I'm putting tissue paper on my body and printing it and pulling it off like skin. I mean, when I was doing it, I wasn't thinking that. But in reflecting upon it afterwards, it opens up another dimension.
And in Stephen's understanding, these pieces are evocative of ritual in some way. There's something there, an energy.
Right, right. Well, that's my greatest hope, that comes through. I mean, when I do work that I'm really in tune with, I'm feeling into it deeply. And it seems from what he has said and others have said that gets transferred. There's a transference of energy. And I know when I'm with it. I know when I'm creating something where that's happening because I'm really in tune with what I'm doing.
And then you're not aware of time passing in that sense.
Right. I'm in that moment just creating, and I'm not looking at clocks. And like when I did this first piece, I don't think I came out of the room until it was dark, and the kids had probably eaten like a gallon of ice cream, which I would never let them do, and I didn't care that day. This was time for this expression.
I've read some about initiation ceremonies, particularly women, and the scarification of women's bodies, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. how that becomes a part of who they are, and it mm-hmm. opens them up to being not just individuals in their communities, but mm-hmm. to a cosmic identity mm-hmm. as well.
You know, I probably relates very strongly to the fact that I've been involved with Zen Buddhist meditation for a long time, for over 30-some years. And the practice is one of sitting, I mean, for those who don't know about it, sitting in silence and starting with following the breath, but then just becoming aware of everything rising and falling away, the breath coming into being and fading away, up and out. And thoughts come into your mind and they leave. And the bird sings and it disappears. And car goes by. And so you become very much aware of the transient quality of things. And I think without my consciously trying to express this, it comes out in the work because I practice it. And if it relates to some kind of ancient ritual or some kind of ancient practice, I feel connected somehow to, I don't know, to the pulse of thing, to the pulse of whatever life's pulse, whatever that is, or however that comes through, through me into the work. And to the point when you talked about scarification, I've always been interested in the body, painting of the body in different cultures, and even the tattooing of the body. And one of the things I've done, I find, is I'm writing on some of the bodies, and I'm using the Dremel to cut into the body to actually scarify it. So you'll see some of the bodies actually have that. And I don't know if I'm consciously or subconsciously connecting to that. I mean, I haven't said I am going to do this because it's an ancient practice, and it's just coming out.
And what would Mom say, do you think, if she came to the opening or if she were able to express something about what you're doing these days?
Wow, I love it. That's stunning. She was just very direct. And I always felt that she was my best critic. And I missed it when she passed away because whenever I would paint anything, I would always have her come. And she was another set of eyes, and I was another set of eyes for her. And I have missed that a lot.
We just speculated about what would happen if your mother were able to attend the opening, but it is open to the public. Tell us more.
Well, I just hope, I would love to see people at the opening at Marywood. There's going to be live music and refreshments, 5 to 7 p.m. on Saturday, November 3rd. And then I will also be giving an artist talk the following Wednesday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So I would love to see people, especially people maybe in the area who I haven't seen in a while. I mean, it's always interesting to me who will come to an opening. So it would be wonderful to reconnect, and I'd love to get your feedback as well.
Hetty Bays, a visual artist who grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, working in mixed media. She has shown her work in numerous solo and group exhibitions, both nationally and internationally, speaking about her life and art in connection with an exhibition titled This Very Body, opening this Saturday, November 3rd, at Marywood University in Scranton in the Shields Center for Visual Arts. There will be a reception open to the public from 5 to 7 p.m. this Saturday. And as we heard, there will also be an artist talk the following Wednesday, so this Wednesday, November 7th, and that also in the Shields Center for Visual Arts. For more information, on the web, marywood.edu/galleries, marywood.edu/galleries, Hetty Bays, and that is an exhibition titled This Very Body, opening this Saturday, November 3rd, with a reception from 5 to 7 p.m. at Marywood University in Scranton in the Shields Center for Visual Arts. And if you need more information, marywood.edu/galleries. The galleries open Monday through Friday, 9 to 4, Saturdays, 1 to 4. And there will be an artist's talk Wednesday, November 7th at 3 o'clock. Hetty Bays is spelled HETTYBAIZ. Hetty Bays, This Very Body, at Marywood University, November 3rd through December 1st. marywood.edu.